And now we're ready to go. This is program number 589, and it's KAZUFM, Pacific Grove, California. This is March 21st, 1983, the first day of spring. I was once married on the first day of spring, my second husband. Can't forget that day. He's a nice guy, but I just, you know how things go. He's not into the research. Okay, John Belushi case. The woman says she's a scapegoat. Remember how outraged I was when Kathy Evelyn Smith was able to inject John Belushi with so many shots and walk away and come back with the paraphernalia and the LAPD let her go? She said today, it's no big deal. They are trying to find a scapegoat and you are looking at her. I believe she is a murderer. The 39-year-old mother of five from Detroit who was killed March 25th, 1965. She was driving the black man in Selma, Alabama, and she was trying to help Martin Luther King with the civil rights marches. Now, the important thing about this article, they're beginning to investigate today the murder of this woman because an FBI man was the man who murdered her. Three people were arrested on this charge, but actually the FBI man himself did the fatal shooting. But the important thing about this was that J. Edgar Hoover had somebody put a puncture in her arm after she was dead, within 24 hours after her murder. They put a puncture in her arm to make it look like she was on dope. And then they published a statement. J. Edgar Hoover sent a memo saying that she has a bad character, that she was sitting close to this black man and they could have been making out, and that she obviously, he suggested, with the needle marks, was a doped-up person who definitely was on narcotics. And the autopsy showed later, when the autopsy report was turned over, there were no findings to explain the puncture mark made by a needle. Now, I have alleged many times that corpses are altered. It wasn't a discussion because it would be impossible to discuss with this particular person who's such an idiot down in Los Angeles, a doctor, on the use of agents of the CIA in hospitals and at mortuaries and so forth. But in many cases, needle marks are put on bodies. And today, there are death squads going around doing murders and saying it's either a drug case, a drug killing, or it's a robbery. All you have to do is find a purse or a wallet empty, and many of these are political murders. And the truth is that they're covered up very nicely because the purse is gone, the wallet is emptied, and or there's a needle mark, and they say, well, you know, they were on drugs. That isn't the way it is, and this is arranged to smear them and hide the purpose of particular roles as civil rights people, as political activists, as playwrights, as actors, and all kinds of things, or general street people who are aware of what's going on in the world. And when you trace what they were doing at the time they died, you realize that they weren't robberies and they weren't drug cases, but they were murders. Another story, Belushi's friend surrenders. Kathy Smith accused of murders in custody in Toronto. With friends like that, you don't need enemies. Belushi's friend, as if they were lifelong friends. Several weeks ago, I sent out a diagram of the spider, the Odessa, and suggested I left seven blank spaces or eight blank spaces to fill in your favorite Odessa fascist Nazi CIA and had this complicated network of various people linked to the intelligence systems. And, of course, my favorite historian, Charles Spears in Texas, pulled in the big ones, the names that are so familiar to me that I actually left them out, the ones that should be there. He brought in some of the best names. Other people wrote to me. But Mr. Bloomfield from Canada, who worked with J. Edgar Hoover and Permandex out of Italy. And then he suggested Mr. Lansdale, Edward Lansdale, of course. But the one I laughed about, the two I laughed about, were J. Edgar Hoover and Reinhard Galen. Now, Galen is the granddaddy of this whole structure, and was knighted a Sovereign Military Order of Malta at the end of the war before he was brought to this country to form the CIA. And I actually didn't have Reinhard Galen on there. He has Frank Sturgis, which is a good one, and Richard Bissell of the CIA. But leaving out J. Edgar Hoover and Reinhard Galen would be like leaving the A and B out of the alphabet. I chuckled when I saw it, and I knew there were eight blank spaces for a good reason. And I'd left out those two top dogs, J. Edgar Hoover and Reinhard Gehlen. Maybe next week I'll give you a list of other ones that people wrote to me and see what you think about their list. Now, several weeks ago, I was talking about the Martin Bormann money, the Nazi money that left Europe. And that is a very important point, how all the banks were drained, how money was counterfeit, the art was sent out, so that the Fourth Reich or the Third Reich would live forever, or the Thousand-Year Reich. And I was explaining, when the airtime was over, out of the book on Otto Skorzeny, the Infield book, the importance of Evita Peron and her demise and how that money was released. And I brought it up in conjunction with the death of Mr. Blue Dorn of Gulf and Western and other people who have come into a great deal of money into the corporate structure in the 50s after Evita's demise. And I just wanted to go over again or finish the section in the Skorzeny book about how that money was released, because it was so important. Beginning in the early 1950s, in July 26, in 1952, Evita Peron died of cancer. Several months ago, maybe 8 months ago, I did a program on the Rockefeller Institute, the doctor from Harvard who worked with the Rockefeller Institute, who was down in Puerto Rico in the 30s, improving and using the technique in the lab of giving cancer to Puerto Ricans and creating the disease so it could be identifiable and caused. This was a part of our government program in the 30s and was pretty well perfected long before Hitler was doing experimentations at the concentration camps. By 1952, Evita Peron died, and as Enfield said, her will left her jewels to the poor and all else to Peron. Of course, they didn't see those. Skorzeny's first move was to obtain $100 million in the assets of the Evita Peron Foundation. That was supposed to be for the poor, and he would take a hold of that money as a starter. Another problem faced Skorzeny on Peron's behalf was Juan Duarte, D-U-A-R-T-E, Evita's brother. He was the richest bachelor in Argentina, and under Argentine law, he had a claim on the wife's estate that would be divided between her husband and her family. And since her Swiss bank accounts had several million dollars and the jewels were worth around $30 million more, Juan Duarte was a threat to the Bormann funds, which Otto Skorzeny was to reclaim. So he had to dispose of the brother. Skorzeny had to be discreet. He had learned through his Nazi grapevine that Juan Duarte had been Evita's courier between Argentina and Switzerland. For 3 years, Duarte had been responsible for delivering $20 million and several suitcases of jewelry to one bank vault in Zurich, in addition to other money. She had 40 bank accounts. This is just one. He signed the necessary documents. Juan Duarte, Evita's brother, went to France and Switzerland, signed the documents to give Juan Peron access to the money. This is Hitler's money that they've put aside, and the jewels that were hidden in Zurich, as well as the Swiss bank accounts in her name. This was the same as signing his own death warrant. As soon as Duarte returned to Argentina, Peron, at the urging of Skorzeny, forced Duarte to resign from a government post which he had. Then Duarte went to Paris, where he had sold a section of Evita's jewel collection. To the Nazi commando Skorzeny, this was the same as stealing money from the treasury, the Nazi treasury. Duarte had signed his death warrant then to even spend a cent of what belonged to the Nazis. Duarte, wise to the ways of the Nazis and to the Argentine dictator Peron, tried to run, and everywhere he went, police were waiting for them, or members of the SS were waiting for him. And April the 9th, 1953, he was found stretched across his bed, murdered in Buenos Aires, a .45 caliber bullet in his head. Officially, the cause was suicide. Unofficially, he was a victim added to the desire to get the money that Otto Skorzeny needed, that they had collaborated with Juan Peron, first Hitler and then Juan Peron. Nor was the death of Duarte the only one connected with the Bormann treasure. Skorzeny had another job to do. Heinrich Dorge, D-O-R-G-E, the former aide of Hallmar Schacht, who helped Evita conceal the funds as they arrived from Germany, made the error of thinking he could share the treasure for himself. Now, Hallmar Schacht was the head of one of Hitler's banks, and John J. McCloyd, who became Chase Manhattan president and worked with John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles and Mr. Donovan and the top Nazis, McCloy released Schacht from prison. But in the meantime, Heinrich Dorge thought that he would get some of this money. He was found dead on a street in Buenos Aires, and no official reason was ever announced. Then Rudolf Freud, F-R-E-U-D-E, the banker with strong Nazi sympathies during the Third Reich, decided that he could have a section of the Bormann funds, that he knew about them and their intended use, and he had a desire to control some of the deposition of this fortune. His involvement with the Nazi money and jewels ended abruptly when he drank a cup of poisoned coffee. According to the Argentine authorities, it was never learned how the coffee got in his cup. Now, Evita was dead, her brother was dead, Heinrich Dorge was dead, and Rudolf Freud was dead, and then Otto Skorzeny was home free with the money. He took the Nazi funds and invested them in German-controlled industry and began going back with Mr. Dr. Fritz Thyssen, T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. Thyssen was an early supporter of Adolf Hitler, very important with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor and the entire network of Nazis all over the world, from Sweden and Germany down to the Bahamas and down to South America. So then, after these four were dead, Mr. Thyssen began to work with Otto Skorzeny and the Argentine government, and then Mr. Dr. Gustav Krupp, K-R-U-P-P, the Krupp family, the dynasty of weapons and guns, was released again by John J. McCloy, and they were home free to begin disseminating hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, what they did was to parlay that into narcotics and gun running so that the accumulation of wealth went into billions and billions of dollars, and nobody has dared ask who are the recipients. We know money was counterfeited, we know that our treasures left, but no one has the nerve to say who are the recipients. And last week I had a bibliography for you. Those of you that get the tapes got the sheet, and those of you that listen to the broadcast can order the sheet for me of the various Germans in this country. And on that list, and I mentioned it before, Mr. Charles Blue Dorn of Gulf and Western, who came to the United States in 1942, right in the middle of the war after Pearl Harbor from Vienna, who built up this multinational corporation under the title of Gulf and Western. I asked the question with you on the air, and because of my research, was he coming from Vienna and going to Detroit and Houston and New Jersey the recipient of the Bormann money that built up Gulf and Western, just as an example of one of the Fortune 500. He was 60th in the Fortune 500. Now, the Wall Street Journal has an article this past week, March the 16th, about Gulf and Western and about the new gentleman who has taken it over, the Martin S. Davis. Not Marvin Davis of 20th Century Fox, and I don't know if these guys are related or not, but this is Martin S. Davis. That wasn't his name. His name was a change name. I have it. I looked up in Who's Who. It's a different Davis, and I have to look up the Marvin Davis and see. His family name was Suraski, S-U-R-A-S-K-Y. But in the Wall Street Journal story, it tells about how they're rearranging the company of Gulf and Western, and it mentions this Martin S. Davis, who was a dropout from college at NYU, worked at Samuel Golden Studios, moved to Paramount Pictures in 1958. 1965, Paramount was sold to Gulf and Western. That's when Charles Blue Dorn came in. And then Mr. Davis became quickly associated to Mr. Blue Dorn. Now, this man, Martin Davis, became number two man, and according to Arthur Lehman, L-I-M-A-N, he was, no question about it, he was the executive vice president. He was number two man in this huge multinational corporation. Now, the man who's giving the quotation about that is from the law firm of Paul Weiss Rifkin Wharton and Garrison, and that may be familiar to some of you. Martin Davis rapidly took over with Mr. Bluedorn. Mr. Bluedorn was from Austria and became an instant success in the United States. The Vatican, Michael Sindona, was to buy 50% of Paramount and get into the combination of Bluedorn and Gulf and Western. And Mr. Bluedorn of Gulf and Western was close to both Michael Sindona of the Vatican and the law firm of Weiss Rifkin and so forth. Now, that's the law office that set up the dummy corporation that Otto von Bolschwing, the head of the Nazi organization, formed in the United States. The lawyer for that organization was the same Rifkin who is the lawyer for Gulf and Western, and also Edward Bennett Williams is the attorney for Gulf and Western, and his name runs through the whole history, the era of almost every sensational mafia, assassin, CIA agent. Edward Bennett Williams has represented those people. Now, Charles Bluedorn's attorney and close associate, along with Martin S. Davis, is the office of Paul, Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, Rifkin, R-I-F-K-I-N-D, Wharton, and Garrison. And as I say, Michael Sindona bought 50% of Paramount, which combined with Gulf and Western. And Gulf and Western, in turn, bought millions of shares of a real estate agency in Liechtenstein and in Europe with Michael Sindona called Societe Generale Immobiliare, and they also put money into the Franklin Bank. Now, the attorney for Gulf and Western, this same outfit of Rifkin, is the attorney for the Vatican that I did on broadcast a few weeks ago with the Sterling Bank Corps and with Chris Kraft. And Chris Kraft bought 20% of 20th Century Fox with John DeLorean on the board of Chris Kraft. And they put Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford on the board at 20th Century Fox. So that Gulf and Western, with their attorneys and with their contacts, is no different than the other corporate structures, the TCI that was set up by Otto von Bolschwing, which was Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's money. We're talking about an organization, the Gehlen Organization, which was Hitler's chief of intelligence, that formed the CIA, otherwise known as the Bormann Brotherhood, or known as Der Spien, S-P-I-N-N-E, or that's the Spider or the Odessa. Now, in a short time, I can't tell you when, but before early summer, you're going to see a story in the newsstands about the links of Otto von Bolschwing with Klaus Barbie and all the top Nazis, the notorious Nazis that make the textbook of the Hitler era. And Otto von Bolschwing was set up in a corporation by the legal attorney that worked for Gulf and Western, and the chronology of these people working together gets more interesting all the time. I've done broadcasts on that before. Now, a subscriber to World Watchers in New York sent me an article, which I don't know how I missed it. I might have, but I don't remember it. It was just recently, April 17th, 1982, this last summer, on a man named Mike Burke, B-U-R-K-E. It's about a man, a happy Yank in Ireland, and Mike Burke at Madison Square Garden in 1977. Now, this is the story of a man who worked in the OSS with William Donovan and went to Italy in 1944, just when the war was winding down. That's the same time period that Mr. Kramer, Fritz Kramer, and Henry Kissinger were in Germany, and William Casey and Prince Bernhard, and working just at the end of that period of the Battle of the Bulge, around December 44. This Burke was in the OSS at this time period. In 1944, he was parachuted to the eastern part of France, where he organized and worked with the resistance and in 1944. And that's when the army was betrayed at Arnhem, the American army, the Dutch army, and the resistance was really a joke. There was this betrayal at that particular time period. He then went to Hollywood, where he was a screenwriter from the OSS. He went to Warner Brothers. Now, Warner Brothers, as I told you last week and at other broadcasts before, is where Errol Flynn worked when he was in the Gestapo, and where Ronald Reagan made two movies with Errol Flynn in that period from 1940 to 1942. This guy went from the OSS to Warner Brothers and was on the same lot as Errol Flynn and Ronald Reagan in that time period. Then he was called back to Rome, and then the CIA was formed in 1947. The OSS became the CIA, thanks to Reinhard Gehlen. And Burke was asked to go over to Albania to try a military coup. They were going to make a clinical case between 1947 and 49 of overthrowing a government for the first time in peace. The war was over in May 8th of 1945. By 1947, the CIA had been formed. By 1949, from 47 to 49, they were going to make test cases. What do you do with a country that appears to be leftist? Can we overthrow it so that it's favorable to us and not to the left movement in Europe? So Albania became a test case for the CIA, and Burke was over there overthrowing Albania, warming up to get rid of Mossadegh in Iran and make that safe for Mr. William Rogers and Chase Manhattan and the Shah of Iran and the Pahlavi family that had been pro-Hitler before and after the war. Before they overthrew Iran and got the British petroleum out, it made it safe for the Americans to have that oil and the profits from that money. They did the Albania case, and he was brought there, and he was also brought by the CIA to Eastern Europe, from the OSS to the CIA, to break up Poland and Czechoslovakia and supply arms and money for the uprisings in Eastern Europe. And then after that, they brought him home to make a movie about his life. Gary Cooper was in the movie in 1955 called Cloak and Dagger. In 1960, he leaves the CIA. He's in the CIA all this time, and goes to Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, where he's general manager, and he stays there 3 years. And I'll do more on the circus and the John Kennedy assassination in a few weeks. I don't want to digress from Madison Square Garden, because this guy begins to work, Mr. Burke, for Madison Square Garden and Mr. Charles Bluedorn, part of the same group that he worked in Eastern Europe. He overthrew governments. He worked for the CIA, the OSS. He goes to the circus for 3 years through that time period, the 60s, from when Nixon lost the election to John Kennedy up through when John Kennedy is murdered. Through that time period, he is working in the circus. Then he moves to CBS. CBS had purchased the Yankees in 1964, and Mike Burke was president. He became president of that team. He worked closely with Joe DiMaggio, and of course you know the story of Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio and her relationship to the Kennedys. He was close to Joe DiMaggio and the Yankees at this particular time. In 1972, the CBS sold the Yankees, and he put together a syndicate with himself and George Steinbrenner and 10 other limited partners. He had left Madison Square Garden, and he was brought back on a contract. Mr. Bluedorn called him and asked him to be chairman of the board of Gulf. Bluedorn was chairman of Gulf and Western. He asked him to be president of Madison Square Garden in 1974. So Mr. Burke took on the role at Madison Square Garden. Here's a guy in the OSS. He's at Warner Brothers when our pals are out there at Warner Brothers. He's overthrowing the Eastern countries. He's in the circus, he's with the football group, and he becomes president of the Madison Square Garden in 1974. A lot of things happen in the sports field or with sports people, and the average public doesn't know how much the CIA is involved in all these different kinds of operations. They have areas covered, such as the circus, the sports fields, the Yankees, the behind the scenes with Albania or Iran and in Czechoslovakia or Poland, working with the insurrection, getting revolutions going at the studios. This is just one man who's retired now to Ireland, and goodness knows what he's doing there in Ireland at this point, if you can believe that these people really retire. But that is a varied career of just one person, and related and hired by Charles Bluedorn to manage his important investment, and of course, Bluedorn worked with Sindona from the Vatican. Now, several weeks ago, I did a program when Mr. Bluedorn died about his coming to this country in Vienna in 1942, his relationship with Michael Sindona of the Vatican, and I want to run down some more of Gulf and Western for you based upon articles sent to me. There are various people in New York who have a fantastic collection on the Gulf and Western. They sent me through the years, and I have many, many files. And now the names and dates make more sense in terms of investigating some of the people that came together during the war or just before the war, the 1939, 1940, where Henry Kissinger came here, his family in 1938. It seems that there was a well-planned intention to bring Germans from Frankfurt, Berlin, and Vienna into the corporate level or into the business level, into the university later, where they'd be heads of departments and directly into the army. They didn't have to be American citizens. They were put right into military intelligence, and they came out on top, literally ruling this country and making the major decisions for this country. So the Gulf and Western is just one corporation, and the reason I believe it's linked to the Bormann money, and I go at length about it, is that no matter what court cases these people come to, and I have a whole series of personalities to share with you from week to week or at different times, they're completely immune from the law. That is one of the secrets. They can't be arrested because they work for the intelligence, and there's some fascinating stories coming out, and you see that they never could be arrested no matter what they do. Now, this Gulf and Western, I left off the biography with a certain time period. Mr. Bluhdorn was investigated. He had Madison Square Garden in 1969, and he was being investigated. There was an investigation going on by the Justice Department from 1969 to 1972. He had invested 15 million shares. He was bought by Gulf and Western into the Vatican investment, the Societe Generale Immobiliare, IMMOBILIARE. And Mr. Bluhdorn had bought 15,000 shares of Gulf and Western stock, and it was paid for by four questionable companies that were being investigated by the Security Exchange. One was the Polly Bergen Company. The other was the Famous Players Limited. And that's up in Canada, and that's one that this Martin Davis is involved with. The other is Gulf and Western Travel Corporation, and the other is Weatherby NASCO, NASCO. Now, you know the story of Michael Sindona's involvement with the Vatican investments, and then Roberta Calvi took them over, and the Vatican has $1.4 billion in 10 dummy fronts down in Panama that are names with doorknobs on them. They're just doors with nothing inside these offices. Well, these are companies that headed by the Commonwealth United Corporation that was supposed to put money into the Vatican and buy 15 million shares of this particular real estate adventure of Michael Sindona. While they were being investigated from 1969 to 1972, in 1970s, the Security Exchange says that Mr. Bluhdorn didn't keep track of the purchase of Paramount Studio by Gulf of Western. He incorrectly had the figures of $14.25 million off. Now, I suspect that a lot of the manipulations in these books and in this corporation could go to master spy networks to continue the Martin Bormann Brotherhood, the Bormann Brotherhood, Odessa going. There was continuous manipulation. One New York Times article says in 1970 there was a discrepancy of $14.25 million as income, and it was 20% of the Gulf and Western money that year that wasn't reported. In 1971, they overstated their income by $7 million, and then by $11 million by improper recording of losses. So that the books were very cleverly being manipulated, and they attempted to hide, according to the New York Times, millions of dollars in motion picture and in aircraft money. Well, most corporations this big have some accounting or good accounts to keep records, but they were off millions of dollars many, many times, and one of the worst times was when they were off $38 million. In 1971, Mr. Bluhdorn personally purchased 11,000 shares of a Gulf and Western subsidiary called APS in 1971, and at that time, APS was negotiating two acquisitions to be paid for in some other stock. So that while Bluhdorn, who came from Vienna in 1942, had built up this huge multinational corporation, there was this shifting of millions of dollars, just as we see going on with the Vatican. But this guy came from Vienna and was immune from the law. We're 1 minute over here. We're going to take a 1 minute break from the regular World Watchers program, and I'm going to ask you if you would think about sending money to KAZU-FM.